You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
On Brand is brought to you by my new book, Get Scrappy, Smarter Digital Marketing for Businesses Big and Small. Available now at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or your favorite bookseller. Publishers Weekly calls Get Scrappy a helpful digital marketing Bible. You can read the first chapter, get special digital extras, and learn more now at GetScrappyBook.com.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? This week, we have a very special 100th episode of the On Brand podcast featuring the one, the only, Seth Godin. Seth is the author of 18 books that have been bestsellers around the world and have been translated into more than 35 languages. He writes about the post-industrial revolution, the way ideas spread, marketing, quitting, leadership, and most of all, changing everything. You might be familiar with his books Lynchpin, Tribes, The Dip, and Purple Cow. In addition to his writing and speaking, Seth founded both Yoyodyne and Squidoo. His blog, which you can find by typing Seth into Google, is one of the most popular in the world. He was recently inducted into the Direct Marketing Hall of Fame, one of three chosen for this honor in 2013. Godin once again set the book publishing industry on its ear by launching a series of four books via Kickstarter. The campaign reached its goal after 3 hours and ended up becoming the most successful book project ever done this way. His book, What to Do When It's Your Turn, is already a bestseller, and his newest book, which we'll talk about in a bit, is pretty big, too. See what I did there.
Seth, yeah, I did. It was great.
Welcome to On Brand.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
So, to not leave the audience in suspense with my very punny quip about your big book, for folks that, you know about all of your other books and says, yes, I've seen a Seth Godin book, this one is decidedly different.
Well, it weighs 17 pounds, it's 800 pages long, it's big enough to kill a small mammal, and it's illustrated with hundreds of beautiful photos from Tom Hawk. It was a labor of love. We only made 5,000 of them, but it's pretty special.
That is amazing. And for anybody that thought that the measurements and specs given there are a joke, that is a true answer. And we will embed a pic in our show notes here. So beyond kind of the technical specs, which normally you don't go into with a book.
Yes, it's true.
what's the book about? What's kind of the unifying idea?
Well, you can find it at moreseth.com. And the unifying idea is the arc of my work, which is what does it sound like when you change your mind? That what I do and what I think most people do, particularly everyone in marketing who's a professional, is we change people. If you're not prepared to make a change happen, you should go home. Changing people requires having a point of view, making assertions, gaining enrollment, figuring out how to be in front of people in a way that gives them both the information and the passion to do something frightening, which is to make change. And that's my work. That's what I do. And this book is a collection of the last 4 years of me doing that.
That's really interesting to think about kind of the arc of your work, because I think I've been there for a lot of that arc and I've read a lot of that arc. Do you have stages that you see in kind of how all of the different pieces of kind of your ethos fit together?
Well, you know, the first 35 years of my life was a struggle to make a living and figuring out a problem that I could solve and get paid for it. And then in 99, I wrote a book called Permission Marketing, And that led to this stage of trying to explain to people how the world of marketing had fundamentally changed, that advertising and marketing are no longer the same thing, even though they had been for 50 years. And there were implications that came from that. And I began with very tactical elements of those implications, like spam doesn't work. But I worked my way forward based on the feedback I got from people. And the feedback basically was, we don't need more specific tactics because we're not taking action anyway. We need to understand why we're so afraid and why, even though our competition is killing us and even though technology is changing our industry, we insist on remaining stuck. And because my thesis is that everything is marketing, what you make, the side effects of what you make, the way you answer the phone, the way you, who you hire, how you compensate them, that's all marketing. I get to write about anything. And so what I've been writing about on my beat is how our self-narrative gets in the way of us making the change we seek to have happen in the world.
I love that. So if everything's marketing, this being the on-brand podcast, is that just a semantics issue? What does brand mean in your school of thought?
Well, let's all agree that brand is not logo.
Right.
Logo is sort of trivial. And if you look at logo in the abstract, it's sort of dumb. A brand is a shortcut. It's a promise about what to expect when you engage. So if you are known, you have a brand. You may not have done it on purpose, but you have a brand. Genghis Khan has a brand. It could have been that Genghis Khan was good at chess. We don't know. But the promise of what to expect from Genghis Khan is not that he's going to beat you if you play chess. And so through our actions, through the way we present ourselves to the world, through our pricing, through our responsiveness, we are able to make promises to people. And those promises mean that when you buy a pair of Nike shoes for $80, you've never actually run in them yet, but you paid the $80 in advance. Why? Because a promise was implied. And if a brand doesn't keep its promises, we don't come back very often.
That's interesting. And when I think about your work too, I was just, when you mentioned everything and the arc of everything, I think my first point of entry was Purple Cow, which I remember as very much, to me, was a branding book for all the reasons that you just said of everything, everything being marketing.
Right. So what Purple Cow argues is, if you can't buy attention, what are you going to do? Because your company, your organization was built on buying attention for less than it was worth, making enough money to be able to buy more attention. So what do we do instead? What we do instead is create interactions and products and souvenirs and experiences that people can't help but talk about. And if they choose to talk about them and they are remarkable, and remarkable means worth making a remark about, and so the word spreads. Well, every brand that was built in the last 10 years, whether it's Uber or Google or Kiva or Acumen or Room to Read, has been built on that one idea in Purple Cow. And it wasn't completely original to me, but I did a good job of putting it in a package that people could understand and run with.
Literally a milk carton shaped package for the first run there. But I love that idea too. And I guess in thinking about revisiting that and then looking back at it, like I'm sure you're doing with each subsequent work, and then looking, like you said, at Uber and the other brands that are emerging, are building on that concept of remarkable experiences, you know, kind of the anti-attention almost.
That's right. So what does Uber do for a living if they don't own any cars or have any employees, right? Well, at some level, it's a software company, but mostly it's a company engaged in connecting to a community that are happy to talk about it and are eager to engage with Uber the next time they have a problem they need solved that fits into the box we call Uber. Every time they screw up, the screw up consists of doing something that makes us feel less of ourselves because we're associated with them. And every time they do a good job, it's because they are helping us achieve a sense of a better version of ourselves.
So another thing that I love about, and I think that you just, did you call your blog your beat?
I didn't call my blog my beat, but I was using the sort of the journalistic term. My beat is the what I'm allowed to talk about, what my promise includes. And my blog just happens to be the most regular way I express that.
Yeah, I've never heard that kind of pulled over to our world, the concept of a beat, but I like it. And about that beat of yours, you've often, as media's continued to expand and grow, many people know that you kind of stick to that blog expression versus all of the other forms of media. And I think that that's a lesson that more brands could take to heart as well, that we're kind of so quick to jump into everything that we kind of risk the kind of jack of all trades, master of none a bit.
Well, I don't think we risk it. I think we seek it out, actually. I think that most organizations don't want to be a meaningful specific. They'd prefer to be a wandering generality. I mean, I don't think the CEO wants that. But I think most people within the organization seek a place to hide. So if because I'm not on Facebook and not on Twitter, other than with repubs of my blog, I can't say, well, I was too busy tweeting today to do a good job on my blog, because all I have is my blog. And owning a thing and a relationship that you know is going to be there day after day is frightening, because you have all your eggs in a basket and you got to work on that basket really hard.
Well, and you know, you say it like that, and it's shocking, because nobody theoretically, if described like that, would want to, like you said, the CEO responsible for vision, that's not where their head's at. But so often the people executing that vision kind of hide in the safeness of the general.
Yeah, I mean, Twitter in particular, I can't think of an entity, a corporation or an individual who has achieved their business goals because of Twitter. They may have done it and used Twitter along the way, but Twitter itself is a hindrance, because it's very difficult to stand out. It's very difficult to be missed if you're not there. It's very difficult to have meaningful interactions that lead to a promise that you can keep. And the thing that's important to remember is, if you are using an online service for free, you are not the customer, you are the product. And that goes for corporations and for individuals. And if it's fun for you, by all means, go ahead and do it. I'm not against fun, but figuring out how to actually earn permission, the privilege of being able to show up in front of people who want to hear from you, who would miss you if you didn't appear, is priceless. And it's abandoned by so many organizations.
Well, and I also think that, the focus that you can give, where you do have permission, where you can make an impact, because I've heard you say before too, that by, spending your time on your blog, you're able to produce, daily posts that, that really do more than the diminished returns you'd probably see if you tried to distribute that across these other formats too.
Well, yeah. And again, that's just me. Everyone shouldn't do that. But my point is, if you can't buy TV every time you want to, where is the bottleneck between you and the people you need to talk to? My guess is the bottleneck is that your boss makes you spam people that you have a relationship with, that the quarter is going to end, or you've got some extra stuff in the warehouse. I don't know. Just email everyone again.
Right.
So when I was running Yoyodyne, we had a 77% open rate and a 35% response rate on the emails that we sent. We invented commercial email as we know it, and those were our numbers for years. I don't think there's a brand today that has numbers like that. And the reason is because it seems like it's free. And because it seems like it's free, people overuse it. they do it selfishly, and then they lose the asset. And the win is to use it properly and to build something that gets better over time, not worse.
So with all of the with the daily posts, with all of the books, how do you know when something, when an idea is a consistent enough theme that it emerges as something that needs to be a book?
Well, if you can figure out the answer to this question, Nick, would you please let me know?
So it just sort of happens.
Well, it's shifted over time. I used to be in the book business, and that would mean, like, when I was a book packager, I did 120 books in 10 years. I'd book a month. So everything I looked at, I said, was, is this a book? Is this a book? Because that's what I did for a living, is I made books. And I brought that into the world that I entered as an author in 99 with Permission Marketing. But after about 6 or 8 or 10 of those books, I shifted gears and I said, what's the best way to bring this idea to people? And since then, I've shifted it even more to, well, a book takes a year. It slows things down, and it's really hard to market. So I'm way more resistant to making books than I used to be. I can reach 10 times more people with a blog post than I can reach with a book. So I may do another book again one day, but I almost never say to myself, is this a book?
Well, and it's interesting, too, as you talk about the arc and everywhere else and being remarkable and more experiential and looking at your last few books. They don't look like any other books on my shelf. And I think that that's something that, I mean, and yet you could flip that the other way and say, look at how similar all of the other books look.
So, well, I'm going to take that as a compliment. Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, the book I did, What to Do When It's Your Turn, which is at yourturn.link. I'm super proud of it. I designed it myself. I wrote the whole thing. But we've also printed it ourselves and ship it to people in packages of 3 or 12 or 99 because I realized most of my readers hate bookstores. And they demonstrate their hatred by refusing to give them money. And it got harder and harder. If you go to bookstores as often as I do, because I love bookstores, what you will discover is that my section of the bookstore is one third the size it used to be. Because the people who buy books like this either don't buy them anymore or buy them on Amazon. So I didn't have a distribution method, but I knew that my readers wanted their friends and wanted their colleagues to think more deeply. So if I could give my readers the tool to distribute an idea, they might grab it. And 150,000 copies in print later, it turns out that's true. Because by shipping people multiple copies, they have this excuse to share it. And we have, I think, more than 100 customers who have each bought more than 100 copies of the book. And so they're the equivalent of the bookstore for me now. Individuals and companies that buy lots of books and hand them out to people who ordinarily wouldn't touch a book. And I don't know if I can do that again or every day, but the impact that this has had, it's huge because now you go to a meeting with 4 other people who have all touched the same book and the same idea, and you can have a different kind of conversation.
Well, it is. It's doing something. I kept thinking while you were saying that it's using the book differently. The purpose is different too, and much better at, I think, what most books try to do, which is move an idea. But that seems to facilitate it in a very, very revolutionary way.
Yeah, I mean, that's my job, right? And it's not every brand's job, but I think it is every brand's job to figure out how to create shared experiences. So one of the things I like to point out is that there's a huge difference between a massage and a haircut. And it's this. If a woman gets a massage, no one says to her, wow, you look fabulous. Did you just get a massage? People don't talk about getting a massage. But if a woman gets a haircut, 20 of her friends will ask her where she got her haircut. And a conversation will take place about the process. That's why it's so much easier to succeed as a hairdresser than as a massage therapist. Because people innately want to talk about it. So what we have in the business-to-business setting, in the nonprofit world, and in the consumer world is the opportunity to build conversations on purpose, to build them into what we make. And too often, we think what we do for a living is make something, but that's not true. Someone can make it cheaper than you. That what we actually do for a living is make meaning happen.
So speaking of sharing ideas, another industry you've kind of turned on its head is higher ed. As both a marketer and a university instructor, I'm kind of fascinated by this. Can you tell us a bit about your Alt-MBA program?
So the Alt-MBA is a 30-day workshop. It's expensive, and it takes 3 to 4 hours a day. We only take 125 people in each section, and we have 10 or 15 coaches, and it takes place all over the world. It's virtual, happens in Slack and in Zoom. And the purpose of the project is to help people level up, to have them see the world differently, to make better decisions, and most of all, to persuade the people around them to take action on their point of view. And what's extraordinary to me about this, the typical online course has a 96%, 97% dropout rate. Only 3% of the people finish most online courses. For us, we have a 98% completion rate and a 2% dropout rate, even though it's 3 or 4 hours a day. And that's because it's not lectures, it's not hidden content, it's not magical secrets. It's experiential, project-based, and transformative. So we've had people from Microsoft and Amazon and Chobani Yogurt, but we've also had people who are freelancers, who are startup companies. We've had people from Charity Water and Acumen and the Red Cross. I'm just so thrilled that I get to do this. We only do it a few times a year, but we're going to keep doing it as long as we're able to find folks who are ready to level up.
It's so interesting, too, because I'm obviously a huge advocate of higher ed, but I'm also the first one to tell you that the establishment of it is a little bit broken, especially in terms of actually helping people. I love that one of the first phrases you said there was helping people level up. And beyond the credential and the cachet or whatever that means, really at the end of the day, it's the people that want to do what they're doing better than they're doing it now.
That's right. I get the privilege of being able to only take people who want to be there. That this idea of compulsory education, those two words, I can't believe they're in the same sentence.
Yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of constructs around education, from the compulsory aspect to it, to the kind of prescriptive paths that we have. It's hard because there's also some forces kind of opposing learning and curiosity in general right now, that it's an odd time in education. But I think that with programs like this, some good can come as a result of it.
Yeah, I hope so. And I don't have any illusion that I can scale this appropriately, but I would love it if people would copy what I'm doing. That's what I've been trying to do for 30 years, to say, I'm doing this. I have no desire to be big. If you want to copy what I'm doing, please feel free.
So I would guess that based on what you said the program's all about, that if you were to, you know, with that mandate of you're not looking to scale, but if there, you know, is a program listening to this, thinking about this, saying, you know, what's one thing we could do to make ours, you know, more in line with what Seth's Alt program is doing? Is it the more experiential, more project-based, less lecture?
Yeah, so no grades, no certification, no tests, no will this be on the test, and 100% of what did you make, what's your opinion, and can I have some comments on it? So everybody does 12 or 13 assignments. Every assignment gets comments from 5 or 6 students, and everyone who does a project has to comment on 5 or 6 other people. So this act of getting public feedback, of posting your work in public, of improving it around and around and around, freaks people out, freaks them out. And isn't that who you want to be working with, right? Don't you want to be working with people who are capable of leaving vitriol aside and saying, I see what you did here, but why did you do that? Let's talk this through. We don't get to do that at work because we think that's political, but it also traps us. And we spend all our time sitting in meetings waiting for someone else to take responsibility instead of each of us accepting it, each of us saying, yeah, I'll do that.
Well, and it's interesting because, and looking back on your work too, it seems like it's also very much in line with your ethos as well, because what that, you know, gets people to do is ship, and, you know, make things happen, as opposed to, like you said, waiting for the responsible party. And then also working within feedback too. That's huge.
I just want to remind everyone who's listening, even if you're super young, that only 10 years ago, new products were a big deal. That when a company came out with a variation, it was something they did a rollout of. But there's been this massive acceleration that instead of an author writing a book every 2 years, now we have authors who are writing a tweet every 6 minutes. That instead of a technology company updating their software every year, we have technology companies that update their software 6 times a day. So in an environment where you don't have a lot of choice, the question is, how long are you going to hold on to something before you find out if it engages the public? And if it freaks you out every time you have to let an idea into the world, you're going to live the rest of your life freaked out.
And boy, when you chart the increase in the rate of change and you kind of plot that next to education, that not only isn't itself changing, but doesn't necessarily encourage or cultivate that same kind of responsiveness, that's a problem too.
Right. We are training people to work in 1937. And there's nothing about the way we train students that is different than it was in 1937. There's more history to teach and there's a little more tech, but the mindset of obedience is still first and foremost. That's where testing comes from. We test people and hold them back if they're a defective batch because we've modeled it after industrialism. But no one listening to this podcast, not one person, is an industrialist anymore. We don't do that for a living. We don't operate a punch press. And so if that's not what you're doing, you're going to have to invest some time and energy to realize that you need a different operator's manual.
Well, yeah, and connecting the right people with the right path too, or with the right operator's manual. I'm just my quick tangent on this is one of our kids, you know, is not a student in a traditional sense of achievement, but we were sitting watching the PBS Hamilton documentary, and in parallel to that, he was going up mentioning all of these facts about the Revolutionary War, and it's like that's not coming through on a test. I don't know how we get at this.
Yeah, and Wikipedia has completely solved the problem of memorization. Anything worth memorizing is worth looking up. And what we need to teach kids to do is lead and solve interesting problems. And it sounds like you're doing that for your kids, but too often we only teach our kids to solve problems we already know the answer to.
Yeah. All of these problems aside, onto sunnier paths as we unbelievably start to wrap up this episode. Seth, what is a brand that has made you smile recently?
You know, I want to pick one that's completely unextraordinary first. And it's extraordinary in its unextraordinariness. So I buy all my domains at hover.com. And here's what happens. If I call them on the phone, they answer after one ring. And if I'm going to get something automatically renewed, they send me an email 5 days before they charge me to tell me that they're about to automatically renew something and charge me. And those two simple signs of respect are easy for anyone to do. And yet they're so rare that they make me smile. And I can contrast this to 1,000 companies that have come up with clever ways to either save money or extract more cash. So who's got a better marketing spend? Hover, who spends their marketing money making me smile by being a good citizen, or these other folks who carve around the edges and then spend their money buying those ads that follow you all over the internet that you wish you would never see again?
I can prove this point and provide contrast. Today, as we're recording this, I gave a final earlier. I know, speaking of tests, but I wanted to take donuts because it was at 7:30 in the morning. And I wanted to call Dunkin' Donuts to say, hey, I have a donut order that might be more sizable. Let's set that aside. They didn't answer their phone. I called four different times and they never answered. I finally tweeted the franchise and they said, can you download the app and place your order there? I was like, yeah. I can't even. So yes, hats off to Hover for having the foresight and extreme advanced intelligence to answer the telephone.
Well said, Nick.
So it almost seems counterintuitive to say, you've mentioned a few and even how people can Google you, but what is your stock answer when folks like me ask where people can go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
Most of the good stuff is on the blog. You could just type Seth into your favorite search engine and I'll be the first or second match. But I was very lucky because my mom was going to name me Scott and my grandfather changed her mind at the last minute, and my SEO has been better ever since.
And you have your mom and grandfather to thank for that.
There you go.
Awesome. Well, Seth, thank you for joining us for our 100th episode of the On Brand Podcast.
Well, thank you for showing up 100 times in a row because it matters. And I'm sure people don't say thank you often enough, but they should.
Well, I appreciate that, and thank you.
Cheers.
And before we go, we always like to flip the microphone around and talk to our community a little bit. And this week, instead of signaling out someone specific, someone in particular, as Seth just did, I want to thank all of you for showing up as well. This certainly wouldn't be much of a show without listeners like you listening to it. So just as Seth thanked me for showing up, I want to turn that back around to all of you and thank you, the community, for showing up, whether that's very vocal supporters who tweet out and comment every episode like Sean Carpenter. Sean, I know you'll find this one and love this one. Or others that are just discovering the show. Thank you. I hope you keep listening. Here's to the next 100 episodes of the On Brand Podcast. And speaking of participating in that conversation, if you like something that you heard on this episode or another, or if you have a question you'd like one of our guests to answer, let me know on Twitter using the hashtag OnBrandPodcast, and you may just hear your thoughts right here on the show. Last but not least, you can find links to everything that Seth and I talked about over at branddrivendigital.com. You can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over there, give us a quick rating and review, help others find the show. If you're looking for that perfect 100-episode gift for a lowly podcast host, can I tell you that nothing will be better received than a simple iTunes rating and review? Head there now. And as noted, On Brand is brought to you by my new book, Get Scrappy, Smarter Digital Marketing for Businesses Big and Small. You can order now at Amazon and check out GetScrappyBook.com for special offers and extras. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.